Sam Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. A charter bus taking Long Island, New York high school students to band camp in Pennsylvania veers off of I-84 northwest of New York City, killing two adults and critically injuring at least five other people. New York State Police Lieutenant Colonel Richard Mazzone.
Preliminary information indicates a failure of a front tire may have been a contributing factor to this accident.
WCBS-TV's Ali Bauman.
Dozens of first responders rushed to the scene just after 1:30 p.m., forced to use ladders to rescue victims as the bus teetered among treetops. Some of the injured were pulled through windows. Crews also scoured the woods to find anyone who may have been ejected.
The National Transportation Safety Board is sending a team to the crash site. President Biden says the first M1 Abrams tanks will arrive in Ukraine next week, and it comes along with another $325 million aid package. This after Mr. Biden's one-on-one with Ukraine's president in Washington, D.C. CBS's Ed O'Keefe from the White House.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky enjoyed a warm welcome at the White House, and President Biden announced plans for the latest installment in aid to Ukraine. Another $325 million.
The American people are determined to see to it that you do all we can to ensure the world stands with you.
But what a difference 9 months makes. Last December, Zelensky delivered a primetime address before a joint session of Congress. Today, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said there was no time for such a speech and wouldn't even be seen in the halls of power with the Ukrainian president.
Zelensky will address Canada's parliament tomorrow. A tropical storm warning is in effect from Maryland to North Carolina with a potential tropical cyclone developing off the South Carolina coast. The Weather Channel meteorologist Chris Warren says the significant threats are expected to move in tomorrow night.
It is potential tropical cyclone 16, and it is expected to bring tropical storm force winds. Tropical storm warnings are posted through parts of the mid-Atlantic and much of the eastern seaboard.
New rules are coming to California to keep insurers from leaving the state. CBS's Wendy Gillette with details.
California's insurance commissioner has announced a new plan that will allow insurers to consider climate risks when setting prices. The upcoming change in rules is designed to stop insurance companies from pulling back on coverage in the state as wildfires and other climate-driven catastrophes increase. Right now, companies are not allowed to factor in current or future risks when deciding what to charge for policies, leading to many insurers pausing or restricting new business. Wendy Gillette, CBS News.
This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit. Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Wattles. A $400 million high-end apartment project at the Mayfair Mall involves the developer purchasing land from the city of Wauwatosa. While the city is providing incentives for the project, including the sale of land at a discount, developer Barrett Lowe Visionary is contributing $1 million to the city's affordable housing efforts. That is more than the cost of the land. A government committee in Milwaukee County is talking about the return of in-person visits in the county jail. James Kelly has more.
The Finance Committee has unanimously approved a $150,000 study to assess the possibility of reintroducing in-person visitation, which hasn't been permitted at the Milwaukee County Jail for over 20 years. Safety was the reason the in-person visits were stopped.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Wattles.
Ready to ride?
Just let me get my flip-flops on.
Whoa, Mom and Dad are going for a ride without their protective gear.
Quick, grab the checklist. I'll grab the gear.
Just where do you two think you're going without your safety gear?
Yeah, you know how we feel about riding without your gear.
Well, it's so nice out.
And we're only going for a short ride.
Not before you put all this gear on, you're not.
But...
riding pants?
Okay.
Check.
Motorcycle boots?
Bye-bye, flip-flops.
Check.
Armored jackets?
Nice.
Check.
Riding gloves?
Two pairs.
Check.
Last but not least, full-face helmets.
Check.
Now you're ready to ride.
And you look cool.
All the gear, all the time. Zero in Wisconsin. Together, we can save lives. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.
Be home on time for dinner.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Saturday, we're going to be heading out to Toledo to march with the striking Jeep workers. And then on Sunday, we're planning on heading up to Michigan. Going to meet our friends who are the Ford workers and maybe talk some to the folks, take some pictures, do some interviews. I think it's going to be a good weekend. And as I've been saying for the last couple of years, this is the time when we adopt a striker. I've been saying, let's start that program. Let's get people out to these picket lines, because the bigger the picket lines, the shorter the strike. The more community involvement, the more people who are showing up and speaking out, again, the shorter the strike. The more people who are looking at these executives and the money that they're putting into their pockets and saying, that's wrong, the shorter this could be. And here to share some thoughts on what's happening and how we can help, I've asked Tiffany Simmons to come talk with us. Tiffany is a UAW 900 member. She's also the chairperson of the Women's Committee there. Tiffany, thanks for taking time for us.
How are you?
I am good. So let's start with the basics. You know, what's going on? Why are we here? Why are you on the picket line? Why are your coworkers walking on the picket line today?
We are on the picket line because it has been a long time coming. We have been politely asking for the things that we are asking for now, which are, for those that don't know what they're called concessions. We are trying to get the concessions back. We are not being paid fairly. We are not being treated fairly. The world has evolved. Every part of this world has evolved, the economy, and it has not evolved for us yet. So we've acted nicely, we've acted not so nicely. Now we're at a point where we're demanding.
Yeah. No, and that's that, you know, look, at the end of the day, you know, as I've said, the strike is the last arrow in the quiver. And it seems like, yeah, you guys have hit that point in the road where hopefully this begins to shock the system and people get a little more serious. Let's talk about, yeah, you personally. How long have you been a UAW member? How long have you been at Ford?
I have been at Ford. It's a little tricky because I started at Ford in 2007 as a part-timer, what's called a temporary full-time employee. And I was a part-timer from 2007 until they hired me full-time in 2012. So I've been at the plant that I'm at now since 2012. And that's actually my fifth assembly plant.
Your fifth? Where did you start off before this?
I started off at Flat Rock, our Mustang plant. I went from Flat Rock to Dearborn Truck. I went from Dearborn Truck to Romeo Engine. And I was actually in orientation to be a part-timer at our Woodhaven stamping plant when I got the phone call to come to Michigan Assembly here for full-time work.
So you basically bounced around the state of Michigan to keep a job.
I was an auto gypsy for a very long time.
And over that period of time, you know, have you seen things get better? You seen things get worse? What's been your experience?
it's almost like a tug of war. At one instance, things get better, but then it gets pulled back in the direction of it's not as good as it could be. I don't think it's ever been as good as it could be. Ford is my family business, or the auto industry is my family business. So I've been a Ford girl since I was 2. Ford has paid for college, for braces, the whole 9. So that's been something for me.
Well, someone's hard labor for Ford paid for that.
Yes. My father is actually still a Ford Motor Company employee. We are pushing him toward retirement now. He's a little stubborn.
Now, unfortunately, he's got a retirement, no?
Yeah.
How many people now at Ford don't have one?
That's the majority right now, the people that don't have one. Whereas he has a pension, I do not. My younger brothers that just recently got hired, I have 3 younger brothers that are now Ford Motor Company employees, they do not. So my dad was kind of last of a dying breed.
Yeah, because last night we talked with a guy from Jeep, and he said, look, you know, when he started in this gig 35 odd years ago, this was the gold standard of employment in this country. It was the top of the working class. It was the job that people spent their lives trying to get. And then when they got it, they stayed. Now it seems like, you know, it's almost like a McJob from what I understand.
Yes. So this job, growing up, this job used to be something that I witnessed. One paycheck could feed an entire family. One paycheck could take care of an entire family. The benefits were good. This was the creme de la creme. We're the Motor City. So this was what it was about. Over the years, by the time I entered the industry, it declined at a very quick rate.
Now, that had a lot to do with the companies getting themselves into trouble by not giving customers what they needed, things that the UAW back in the 60s said that they needed to be doing, but they chose not to. So when they got into trouble, they came to the employees and said, look, we want stuff back. We want massive concessions. And look, they won massive concessions. They are profitable. They are massively profitable because of their employees.
Yes. And the thing is, those concessions, they were never meant to be. From my understanding, they were never meant to be permanent. We were saviors of the auto industry when they came to us for those concessions. Oh, the UAW, they had so much gratitude for us when we helped them out, when we rescued them. They were forever grateful. Until we asked for the things that we wanted back. It's like letting someone borrow money. They tell you, okay, well, when I get back on my feet, I'll pay you back. They get back on their feet. They buy a yacht. They buy a Porsche. They get a mansion. They live in a gated community. And then when you look and you say, hey, can I have that couple of $100 back? Not only do they tell you you can't have your money, but then they call you ungrateful.
And greedy.
And keep your money. And greedy. And keep your money that you loaned them because you saw that they needed it. So that's kind of how we feel right now. We just want our loan back.
Is that the sentiment on the picket line? Is that what your coworkers are thinking? Because I know there are a lot of people who are angry. I know that, you know, the frustration has built over the years on a lot of levels for a lot of different reasons. So all this just seems to be coming to a head right now. But is that the common theme?
Yes. The whole theme of give me my stuff back. That's it. Like, I'm not asking you I might ask you for a couple of extra dollars interest, but it's because you've had my stuff. You're holding my stuff hostage.
So when the mainstream media loses their mind over the 40% number, when Nikki Haley says, oh, well, you know, they're offering 20. That should be good enough. This is why we don't let unions in South Carolina. What do you think?
It's so easy for people to sit on the sideline and say what we deserve and what we should have. People that do not come in that plant with us, people that do not work on those lines with us. It is, and I've said it, it's been an ongoing thing. It is laughable and it is insulting that the CEOs of these companies are calling what they are offering us generous while they're literally making a whole assembly plant's wages. And they're calling it performance based. Ms. Barra said that it's very generous.
And I asked the question, maybe you have the answer. How many lug nuts have you seen her put on? How many windshields has she installed? Has she put a hood on a car? Does she know how to put a hood on a car?
I wouldn't think that she knew how to put safety glasses on at this point. Because I've never seen her on an assembly line. So I'm trying to figure out what performance, other than the Grinch that stole Christmas, are they performing?
She said that 93% of her wages or her compensation is because of merit. I'd like to know what the other 7% is for. But if that meritocracy idea is where we're going, shouldn't you guys get, you know, much higher wages because you're the folks who actually build the product?
We are. That's the thing. Everybody is making money except for the people that are doing the actual work.
Well, that's the American dream, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's a nightmare at this point. There are people that come in, cuts, bruises. They don't get to spend time with their family. They're working around the clock to make ends meet. And you have people that all they have to do is delegate and sign paperwork and tell us that we're ungrateful. And that's their performance.
And greed.
That's what entitles them to the money that they make.
So walk us through the average day, because I don't think most people know what it's like to work on an assembly line. You know, we get to see, videos where it's nice and clean and you've got robots doing all this kind of stuff. What's it like? What's your average day look like?
And that is so glamorous. The stuff they show you on the TV and on news clips and stuff is like the most glamorous stuff in the world. I actually say, hey, I want that job, because it's not how it goes. An average day for an auto worker is you start your day with a couple curse words, a couple good stretches, and you go into a building and nothing. You go into a building and it's nothing like they think. All that, you come out clean, you go in, you come out, your clothes are torn, you have grease stains that you have to literally become a laundry chemist to get clean. You've eaten 3 cold meals throughout your night. You've been away from your family all night. A regular work week for me, and I'm a production team leader. So what I do, I'm responsible for a team. I'm responsible for their bathroom breaks, if anyone has to make a medical call, if anyone has to step away from the line for any reason, I fill in their job for them. I'm responsible for making sure that they have the proper personal protection equipment. I'm responsible for making sure that the line starts up on time, and I do repairs.
So you're like the jack of all trades. You're like the everyone.
The Jill of all trades, hon. And a regular day is about, for me, is 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. I just visit home. My daughter and my dogs and my family, they're running my house right now. I'm just the visitor. I stop in from time to time and I just pay rent.
So this is the reason for the 32-hour work week. And look, I love the fact that someone's finally saying, you know, and now here's the thing. Do you think you're going to, let's start there. Do you think 32-hour work week is possible?
You know what? I think it's possible. It's kind of like, it's one of those things where you're like, no, this can't be. It's too good. It sounds too good to be true, because we're so conditioned to living in these assembly plants.
Yeah.
And that's the 32-hour work week. That's the least of what we're asking for. At this point, ending tiers is up there on it. The wages is up there on it. Pensions. I would love to have a pension when I retire. I would love to have better benefits when I retire. I would love to have the package that my dad had. I would love to have that, but I feel like I'm working double time to get half of what he's getting. And eggs are $8 right now. Everything has gone up except our wages.
And this is how we fight for better wages, hours, conditions. Last question I've got for you. You know, I was looking at Tim Scott yesterday, and good on your union for filing a complaint against his comments. He said that, you know, citing Ronald Reagan when he fired the Patco workers, he said that if you strike, you get fired. Any thoughts to the presidential hopeful Tim Scott?
Well, he doesn't have much hope at this point talking like that, because this country was built on the backs of unions. This company was built on the backs of middle class workers. It's really easy for someone that hates a union to say that we need to be fired, when again, I don't think he could last a day in an assembly plant. So maybe that's his resentment talking, that he doesn't have that grit in order to do what we do. Is if you can't beat them, join them. Apparently he can't beat us, but he wants to beat us down.
There you go. Tiffany, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll good luck. You know, one day longer, one day stronger. I wish you guys the best, and I'd love to have you come back and talk to us again down the road.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate Tiffany Simmons, UAW Local 900. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Hopefully I'll see Tiffany when we're in Michigan on Sunday. Again, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you've got questions, comments, something on your mind, quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Taylor Swift has... I don't know why I continually find stories with Taylor Swift in them. I'm not a Swiftie, but you know, good on her for taking on Ticketmaster. Really good on her. Good on her for signing a contract with the Writers Guild and getting them the things that they need so that she could move on her film. And this, evidently an Instagram post drove a record-breaking amount of web traffic to vote.org. And evidently this week helped to register 35,000 new voters. Holy cow is right. Can she do it again today? Because look, there's a generation of folks who need to be encouraged. Young people, we need you to vote. And then, you know, not just register, but get out there and actually vote. And here in Pennsylvania, good on Governor Josh Shapiro. Signed into law automatic voter registration. This is what I've said for the longest time. There's got to be a way that, you know, everybody is in. And the whole registration process to me is, you know, too cumbersome, and just there should be a way of every person having the ability to cast their ballot. I'm a big fan of same day registration, big fan of instant runoff voting. There are things we should be doing to make voting easier. And well, democracy is participatory. Now, here's the thing. Dave McCormick is going to be running for Senate in Pennsylvania, I guess. He ran last time, lost to Dr. Quack, Oz, the New Jersey guy in the primary. So the Connecticut guy lost to the New Jersey guy to run for Senate in Pennsylvania. Turns out he's running again this time, but it'll be against Bob Casey instead of the open seat that eventually John Fetterman won. But the former hedge fund manager, he evidently still lives in Connecticut. And look, that's okay, I guess. You know, our rich people, they live in a lot of places. So, you can easily buy a house in Pennsylvania and just to skirt the rules there. But travel home on the weekends. You know, what's the big deal? I think it kind of is a big deal, don't you? I remember when Rick Santorum ran against Harris Wofford and accused him of, not living in the state, and actually went to his house and, showed, all kinds of things. And then you find out that he wins a seat and he does the exact same thing because he was Pennsylvania's senator who lived in Virginia, which I think is probably, where he probably still lives, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure. If anyone knows, by all means, drop me an email. The Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, Rupert Murdoch's rag. They have their editorial folks who asked the question about Donald Trump not debating. Is he worried he'd look his age at 77 next to younger candidates? And I'm going, no, I don't think that's it at all. I think he's like, why bother? None of the Republican candidates are nowhere close. I mean, it's not even a matter of, it's competitive. No, it's not even close. Second is way down the road. If I were him, I'd go, call me when someone's within 40 points. And, you're sticking up for Trump. No, I'm not. I'm just saying, this is an idiotic editorial. Now, is he old? He's 77 years old. Does he sound 77? Yeah. He's struggling to speak too. Sometimes he says things and you don't see many TikTok people, and there's not a cottage industry of using all of the Trump nonsense on every video. I see Biden stuff all the time because there's money in it, I guess. But Trump's an old guy too. The reality is we're going to have two old guys running for president. One old guy has really good policies. One old guy is actually rebuilding our infrastructure. One old guy is actually helping workers organize and putting people in the positions to do better. One guy is actually doing what he said he was going to do. The other guy, first in history to attempt a coup. Still sticking to the big lie. Still sticking to that the election was rigged, even though half of his own party is saying, no, not rigged. You lost. Isn't it odd? Now, what I find interesting is every time Trump speaks, Exhibit A, here it is again. And it's one of those things that, just the other day he was talking about how he didn't listen to his lawyers, which I found hysterical. Because my first thought was, did Trump just fall on the sword for his lawyers? Did he just let them off the hook? They could come back now and say, look, I gave him all this advice and he didn't follow it. He followed his own accord, and it's all on them. Which is why I think Lynn Wood, the former Trump lawyer, now evidently star witness for the defense down in Georgia, for the prosecution down in Georgia, could be quite troublesome. Yeah, I'm stumped sometimes when I hear the, Joe Biden's old. Yeah, so is the other guy. Age and experience used to be good things in this country. I don't know when it became bad. I love the fact that Biden's calm. He has had a major calming effect on this country. And that is a good thing. We needed to cool the temperature a bit. But a steady hand and smart policy looking to the past to say, we can recreate those really good things that our grandparents fought for. You listened to Tiffany there a second ago, talking about her father, the job her father had and still has, and the lifestyle that it afforded. That's what that job used to mean. And now it's just like any other job. Struggling to make ends meet. Having to work a bunch of overtime to get ahead. You know, if we had those old Ford jobs back, there's that trickle-down effect. Or the rising tide effect, however you want to frame it. When their jobs get better, everybody's job gets better. Because we all start demanding. We all start wanting a bigger slice of the pie. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. That was the day that members of the Culinary Workers Union Local 226 went out on strike against the Frontier Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. What they did not know was that the strike would last for more than 6 years, becoming one of the longest work actions in U.S. labor history. The Frontier was the second casino to open on the Vegas Strip in 1942. At the time of the strike, the Ilardi family owned the historic casino. The Ilardis were vehemently anti-union. They renovated the old facility and then reopened, refusing to sign a contract to pay its workers the same rate provided at most other Vegas casinos, claiming that the Frontier was too small to match the wages of the larger outfits. Management refused to budge from their position. In response, Local 226 members mobilized. The year before, Hattie Canty had been elected president of the local. She was a black mother of 10 children and a widow. She had worked as a hotel maid. Her leadership brought a new determination to the Culinary Workers Union. Local 226 set up 24-hour picket lines outside the Frontier. The strike was joined by Bartenders Local 165, Teamsters Local 995, the Operating Engineers Local 501, and the Carpenters Local 1780. The strike became an important moment in Vegas labor history, as other casino owners looked on watching the labor battle unfold. The unions stood strong. The picketers demand that the owners should, quote, sell, shut down, or sign, became the call. In the end, the Ilardis decided to sell. The new ownership signed a union contract and rehired 280 striking workers. Triumphant union members cut a red ribbon at the hotel to mark their victory.
Oh, thank God for Ted Cruz. Once again, the far right-wing U.S. senator is saving you and me from a political horror that doesn't exist. This is Ted's specialty, for he seems unable to deal with the real economic and social problems that workaday people actually have. Thus, he constantly tries to divert attention from his senatorial incompetence by staging embarrassing political stunts, such as his furious fulminations against Big Bird, Mickey Mouse, and other fictional characters. Unable to triumph over them, however, Cruz is now conjuring up entirely fictional conflicts to let him, a Harvard-educated elitist, pose as a hero of working-class commoners. Beer drinkers, for example. The Cruiser recently swooped onto a Republican TV show squawking like Chicken Little that Joe Biden intended to restrict us Americans to only 2 beers a week. Oh, the horror! What is it with liberals that want to control every damn aspect of your life, squealed the senator, who, by the way, does want government to control every woman's reproductive rights, people's voting rights, the rights of labor, what books people can read, etc., etc. But Ted's in a tizzy over Biden's 2-beer limit. Only, there's no such thing. Actually, Biden has said nothing about beer. Zero, zilch. Joe's kind of busy. You know, Ukraine, global warming, healthcare, real problems. So, unlike the little senator from Texas, he doesn't have time to play political pickleball. This is Jim Hightower saying, embarrassingly, such other GOP officials as Iowa Senator Joni Ernst have joined Cruz's screwball crusade to stop Biden's non-existent beer bust. It's like they all went to clown school to learn to be senatorial. As for Ted, his nonstop series of nutty PR antics reveals that he is to a real senator what near beer is to beer, only not nearly as close.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I love the fact that, everyone's got Elon Musk on their mind. And again, I see him as an authoritarian figure. The guy who, if you don't do what I say, we'll put you in your place. Perfect example. When the UAW workers went on strike, Elon Musk revoked the paid blue checkmark the UAW had on their X account. And only after people said, hey, wait a second, you can't do that, did he then reinstate it. But his first inclination was, we need to silence those people. Because understand, when you pay for that, that coveted blue checkmark, when you pay Musk, you get, you know, much more exposure. They push you to the front of the line. Your algorithm goes crazy because they want your money. It is a pay-for-play thing. Now, remember, he said it was all about free speech. He bought Twitter because of free speech, only now you got to pay for it. And now everyone's going to have to pay for it, according to some reports. And if that happens, we will be leaving Twitter. But here to share some thoughts on Elon and, well, the latest dust-up at Tesla, I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. Great to be in your show. Thank you.
So what do you make of this blue checkmark thing? To me, this is just another example of someone who has power, too much power, and someone who's going to abuse it. Absolutely.
I think Mr. Musk, he wants to be thought of as like a father figure. And, oh, everyone does what I tell them to do because I'm the daddy, you know, and, you know, kind of like when you go to the park with your 3 and your 4-year-old, they kind of follow you around, you know, and they don't even think about going somewhere else. I mean, that must be what he thinks, I guess. I mean, I don't know.
The benevolent dictator.
He wants to be the benevolent dictator. And like, I mean, personally, I have 2 kids and they're both adults now and 33 and 30. I never wanted to be the benevolent dictator. You know what I mean? I was too lazy to micromanage them. So
it's not fair to them either. But the reason I bring him up is, you know, there's a story that they're now suing the NLRB, and the decision that the NLRB made, I guess it was a year or so ago, to allow some of the workers to allow workers to wear shirts with a UAW logo on it. And look, that's part of what the law allows. You're allowed to have buttons and stickers and t-shirts and hats. You're allowed to wear those things. You're allowed to put stickers on your car. That's all been decided. And yet Elon's fighting this. Why?
I think it's just part of his desire to be paternalistic or something, or his desire to be a dictator. It's like the law is pretty clear. It was their case in the 1940s. It's like you can say that you can't wear a metal pin if you're running an x-ray machine or something like that because it's dangerous. But you have to, but like wearing t-shirts, you know, they said everyone has to wear black t-shirts. That's the rule. And the UAW gave them black t-shirts, just took out the word Tesla and put in the word UAW instead of the logo. And like, they've been going to court on this for years now. And even though it's in California, they decide to appeal it in Texas because that's where their headquarters is now. And it's like, why are they trying to antagonize people? It's like, I just don't get it. It's like, they don't want good relations with their own workers. They want the workers to see them as like, to fear them as like overarching dictators. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, Elon Musk grew up in South Africa. Maybe that's how they do things there.
Maybe. But, you know, I look at Pennsylvania's workers' compensation law, and I say this all the time. It still refers to the employer-employee relationship as master and servant. And there are people who still have that on their mind, that the employer is the master and the workers are their servants. Because, look, the NLRA, when originally written, understood that workers had no rights. The employer decided what hours they'll work, what days they'll work, what working conditions are, who they'll hire. They decide everything in the workplace. So when the NLRA was written, it was to ensure that workers got some bit of voice, some bit of rights, and the ability to collective bargain and to organize, to have some power in the workplace was what our law sought out to do. And that's always been a sore spot with the employer class, because they want to be that benevolent dictator.
They do. And they have their business. And the same way you can't go to each and every part of the Tesla factory and apply for a job separately and see who will pay you more. Well, the Tesla owners can't go to each individual worker and try to make a different deal with them. They have to deal with the union. That's how it should be. And the same way that the capital can collectively bargain, labor should be able to collectively bargain too. But Mr. Musk doesn't want to treat people fairly. He wants to be in charge of everything. And
well, let me ask you this.
That's not the American way.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, I spent a couple of days last week talking about this CEO, a guy named Tim Gerner. And I don't know if you know who he is or you know, where this came from, but he was you know, on a panel. He was, you know, doing a presentation, and he said, look, he wants to see 40-50% more unemployment. He wants to see pain in the economy. He wants to see workers, you know, back in their place. He wants them to know, he said, because you know what, you know, workers shouldn't be grateful to the employer and not think that the employer should be grateful to them. And I said, look, this is what the CEO class believes. They want obedient workers to be in their place and not demand too much, but just show up, make the profits, and go away silent. It's my view that that's pretty much all of the CEO class. Am I wrong?
I used to think you were wrong. I now am beginning to think that you're right. It's just sad. And that's not the way I would want to run a business. I want people to like to work with me. That's what I tell the workers who work in my organization, the Patriotic Millionaires. We have, you know, 12, 15 employees, and I want them to be happy there. But I was actually reading The Capital Order, how economists invented austerity, Clara Mattei's book. And it's true. They actually want a kind of a relationship with workers, that workers are like an underclass and the capitalists are like the first class. And that's been part of capitalism for, you know, all of the last century, if not before. And we've been trying to fight against that with labor unions and sort of change that. And we can, it can be done, but they are fighting tooth and nail against it. And I just think that it's a losing battle and they're not on the right side of history.
Yeah. Well, they're on the right side of the balance sheet though, because, you know, I'm looking at, you know, I know, you know, the UAW members are on strike at three plants in Michigan, Ohio, and Missouri. And we'll see what happens tomorrow, depending on what goes from there. But I was reading through some numbers, $250 billion over the last decade, the big three have made. But the one that jumped out at me, $66 billion in stock buybacks. That's telling me on their side of the ledger, they're cashing in.
Yeah, that is the owners of the company taking cash out of their company, billions of dollars worth. And yeah, if you own the company, you're allowed to do that. But you also should be willing to pay your workers enough that they can make a good living. And if, you know, if the high paid people are getting raises, well, everyone should be getting raises, because you don't want to have a country with a few rich people, not the poor people. That doesn't work if you're trying to sell cars to people. Even Henry Ford understood that. It's just a sad thing. And we have to change it. They're even arguing about how much money, you know, whether they make more money at Tesla or not. And they might, the people at Tesla might make more money because they can get stock options if their stock goes up, or they'll make less money if their stock doesn't go up because their actual, you know, their actual pay from their jobs is less than UAW rates. But we just have to live in a country where people can be treated fairly. We have to change the attitudes of these managers who just insist that they be in charge of everything. And I think we are. I think the company, I really think the automakers are going to come to an agreement with these guys. They're not that far apart. The UAW wants 40%, but over the course of 4 or 5 years, the automakers are offering, you know, 20% plus a cost of living adjustment, which is I think is going to be pretty close, but they're talking kind of different languages. So, I mean, I have a feeling that they're going to end this strike reasonably soon.
Well, that's the hope. I'm optimistic. You know, because nobody wants to be out on that picket line. Nobody wants to have to worry that they're not going to be able to pay their bills. Look, I've been on strike before. I know what it's like to miss a paycheck when you're fighting for something. And look, I get it. So the hope is that it is short. But, you know, my problem is, and this is a much bigger, this is a societal thing for me, Morris. And you're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Morris Pearl. He's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do there. And they do incredible stuff. Because this goes back to, you know, the wheelhouse that you're in. I believe our tax code has done a lot of damage to the employer-employee relationship. Because you go back to the 1960s, when the GM CEO was making 20 times what the average worker was making. You now got this Mary Barra who's making $29 million a year, which is 360 times more than the average worker there. And you go, something is skewed. What caused that to happen? And I argue it's the fact that we don't have a high top marginal tax rate.
Yeah, because... And a large part of her money is coming from her stock-based compensation, as they call it, stock options. And she pays even a lower tax rate on that. And if we had higher tax rates, people would not be looking to earn these tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollar paychecks. They'd be happier owning part of their company, and they'd be happier spreading the wealth more if we had, you know, more progressive tax structures like we did when maybe America was great back in the 50s and 60s, at least for the white males.
Yeah, because I've been talking to auto workers this last week, and we're going to go to Toledo on Saturday and up into Michigan on Sunday to walk the picket lines and talk to people there. And the story that I keep hearing is, this was a good, solid, upper middle class, working class job, 40 years ago, and now it's almost a poverty wage job, and it's indicative of most industries for working people. Finance folks have done really well, and some of the other stuff, but for people who work for a living, or their backs are aching at the end of the day, or as Ed Schultz used to say, the people who shower at the end of the day, things have gotten tough, which is why I think you see this anger and this frustration, which isn't good for anyone.
I think the anger and the thinking of the unfairness is just as important as the money. I think that even people who are being paid a reasonable hourly wage are just angry still if they're being treated like children and being told what to wear and what to do and how to do this and how to do that and being looked down upon. And I think we have to respect the people we work with. They're not below us. They're not lower class of people or something. They're just people who happen to work with their hands in a factory floor instead of, sitting around pressing buttons on their keyboards in an office. But that doesn't mean they're lesser quality people or something. In some cases, they're better quality people. I couldn't do what they do.
Well, it's, as I always say, every job has dignity. Every job should be respected. And part of that respect is making sure that you can keep a roof over your head and food on the table. Most working people I know, they don't want to make a killing. They know they're never going to be millionaires, but they don't want their kids to go hungry. And I look today, we're talking about Tesla and T-shirts. You've got Joe Manchin running around, seeking a proposal to reinstate suits in the Senate. Yet he's a guy who's responsible for a 60% rise in childhood poverty in this country because they refused to extend the child tax credit. We're fighting over clothing when real issues are affecting real people.
You look at the conservative media, Fox News and the like, that is front page news everywhere. Senators not wearing suits and ties anymore. That is the most major story for the other side in right-wing America is, Schumer and the Democrats destroying the country by getting rid of the dress code in the Capitol building. Like, really? That's the most important thing? I mean, it shouldn't be.
No, but it's that thing that it's the shiny thing, Morris, and you know this as well as anyone. It's the shiny thing to keep us outraged and upset and give us something to be mad at, while the things that we really should be mad at go unnoticed.
Yeah, I mean, that's been true since, you know, the Roman empires had, you know, lions eating people in the Colosseum, and you know, people have been distracted by, you know, wars and foreign countries, you know, centuries later. It's just sad that that's what our leaders do for millennia, is sort of give people something to be mad about, so they forget about the fact that they're being mistreated and, you know, working on us for austerity wages. And like, it's just, we have to change that. And that's what the UAW and Sean Fain is trying to do, is to stand up for this finally. And I was in the Sidney Hillman room today having a meeting. He's the one who started Amalgamated Clothing Workers. Yep. And he started that because they were going on strike over 100 years ago, and the union leadership caved and signed with the employers and even sent people, but the workers there refused to go back to work. And it took years, and it took people fighting against not only their employers, but their own union leadership. You know, they finally started a new union and got rid of the United something or others and started the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And, you know, then they started the CIO, which later merged with the AFL. And it's, you know, people leading, and the same way it reminded me of Sean Fain becoming the leader of the UAW, you know, because people were getting fed up with the previous leadership that was talking about givebacks and getting too close to management. And I think it's the same thing that we had 100 years ago.
No, I'm thrilled with him, and I think he's doing a great job. Because I think he's doing a good job in that he's talking about the issues not in a right-left, red hat, blue hat, but in the up-down frame that I think is important. That, you know, when Trump said he was going to go to Detroit and meet with auto workers there, you know, he's like, look, he's one of the people that we're taking on. We're going after the billionaire class and people like him, and I thought it was the right frame.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's not like everyone in the red hats or blue hats are good or bad. I mean, we have, you know, we have problems with people on both sides of the aisle sometimes. And I think we need people to remember to stand up for the people who are doing the work and not talk about, oh, we must keep them tied to their employers. Oh, we must make them subservient to their masters. And like, that's the wrong framing. And we have to change that.
Yep.
I think he's trying.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled with where we're heading. But Morris, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick. Great to talk to you.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got a question, comment, something on your mind? That's how you get to me. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're looking people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that labor activist Mother Jones led a march of miners' children through the streets of Charleston, West Virginia. Her aim was to illustrate the effects of poverty. In the speech she gave that day, Mother Jones declared, "Tyranny, robbery, and oppression of the people must go. The children must be educated." Her march took place during the 1912 to 1913 Paint Creek, Cabin Creek coal miners' strike in that state. During the strike, gunfire was exchanged between members of the United Mine Workers and the mine owners' hired private army. The governor declared martial law on three separate occasions. Mother Jones was arrested in February of 1913. She was accused of conspiring to commit murder and brought before a military court. She refused to recognize the legitimacy of her court-martial. Mother Jones was sentenced to 20 years in the state penitentiary. While she was under house arrest for 85 days, Mother Jones contracted a dangerous case of pneumonia. She was 76 years old. Her support of the miners and subsequent trial helped build the reputation of Mother Jones as a tough union activist and the miners' angel. It also helped lead the U.S. Senate to launch an investigation into conditions in the West Virginia coal mines. When Henry D. Hatfield was elected governor of West Virginia, he was determined to end the labor crisis. He released those who had been convicted under the military court. On May 8th, Mother Jones was set free. Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, continued her fight for working people. Mother Jones's trial helped to spotlight the low wages coal miners earned, the long hours they worked, and the dangerous working conditions under which they toiled. One of her most remembered quotes is, "Pray for the dead, but fight like hell for the living." Quite remarkable when you stop and think about it that Elon Musk would spend that kind of energy to ensure that their workers don't have a UAW logo on their shirt. I mean, you know, when you think about it, there's a guy who's extraordinarily punitive. And look, you know, this is what happens when you get people who have the kind of obscene wealth and power that comes with wealth. This is what they do. So was it surprising that Tim Gurney were saying, you know, we need to get those people back in place. We need to get them, you know, back to being grateful to us. Anyone surprised by that? Anyone surprised that they want a recession? Why do you think the Republican Party's been begging for recession for so long? It's because it's what their owners are telling them. Get those people back into the workforce. Get them back. Cut off those social programs, make people desperate again. And understand, you know, when they push for these work requirements, it's about pushing more people into the workforce. So you dilute the labor pool and then lower wages. We saw this back when Clinton was president. If you remember the heated economy under Clinton, the McDonald's down the street from me, not a minimum wage, was what, $5.15 an hour? The McDonald's down the street from my house when I lived in Allentown was $10 an hour. That's what they were making back then. And that was good money. You know, working at a McDonald's for $10 an hour in the mid-90s was not bad. They passed welfare reform. Immediately that $10 an hour McDonald's job goes back down to just above minimum wage. Like $5.50 or something like that. Because what you did is you pushed a whole bunch of people back into the workforce. You know, you increased the surplus labor. And what happened is it drove wages down. But Rick, you don't want people just sitting around. No, I don't. But when you force people into, especially the low-wage jobs, the bottom falls out. And that's what the employer class wants. You know, you hear people complaining about bars and restaurants. You know, the David Brooks thing that I talked about earlier, $78 for a hamburger and a drink at the airport in Newark is obscene. Never mind the fact that 80% of it was alcohol and him, you know, probably drinking himself blind drunk. But what you're supposed to get from that is, well, those greedy workers at the airport, you know, they're making too much money. That's the reason it's so expensive, because of labor costs. When that's furthest from the truth. But now that they have to pay a reasonable wage to someone working in a restaurant, now you're hearing them complain. What's interesting to me is why we haven't heard the business class say that we want immigration reform, that we want to bring in more immigrants to get them to do the low wage work that most Americans aren't doing for you know what the minimum wage is for tipped workers in Pennsylvania? I think it's like $2.93. You know, how many people are going to take that job? We got lots to accomplish. And it comes back down to politics. As long as we can get past the red hat, blue hat, as long as we can get past suits are the most important issue of the day. I mean, I'm still shaking my head that this is even an issue. But welcome to the American political system. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.